Section, National Council of Jewish Women, March 15, 1989. Harold Kimball and Ann Fagan interviewing Judge Martin Wexelman. Tape 1, Side 1. Let's begin, please, with you, Judge Wexelman, stating your full name, your address, and your date of birth.
Well, my full name, as I'm known generally, is I. Martin Wexelman. My address is 825 Morwood Avenue, and my date of birth is February 6, 1928, during the administration of Calvin Coolidge.
Okay, we're going to begin by talking about your childhood. I'd like you, if you will, please, to talk about your parents and the family in which you grew up.
Well, my parents are both immigrants. Both came from the Ukrainian Pale in an area known generally as Volyner Gubernia, which I understand is in the area of Zhytomyr and Bardichev, north of Kiev. My mother lived in a shtetl, which was known as Romanov. My father lived Affendorf, as they say, that is out in the countryside. His parents were rather unusual for Jews in the Ukrainian Pale because they dealt with the Russians. My paternal grandfather, I am told, was engaged primarily in the manufacture of bootleg vodka and dealt with the mujiks generally. My mother lived in the shtetl. She is a fingeret. You may have heard that name. She was one of 12 children. 11 of whom I knew. One died in Europe, but 11 of them got to this country. And
when, approximately, do you know?
Well, beginning, I guess the first of them arrived around the time of the First World War or shortly thereafter. My mother was the 11th of the 12 children in age. Well, actually the 10th. Because there was a twin boy and girl who were the 11th and 12th. She's the only survivor, my mother. But I, as I said, I knew 11 of the fingerettes, and virtually all of them were in the Pittsburgh area. One was a baker down in Uniontown. One was a baker in Los Angeles. Several were in the scrap business in various areas around Pittsburgh and in other enterprises, and there still is a pretty good-sized fingerette family in the area, although, as I say, my mother is the last of the 12 fingerette children, 11 of whom came to this country. My father was one of four children. He and a brother both came to this country. The rest remained in Russia, and were basically exterminated by the Nazis when they invaded the Ukraine in 1941.
When did your father
arrive? My father and mother both came. They weren't married at the time. Mm-hmm. They knew each other, but there was no attachment between them. My mother and father both came to this country separately, of course. During the Russian Civil War, not the Revolution, but the Civil War between the Whites and the Reds, 1921. My father came in through Canada, my mother through Cuba, in the traditional fashion for what was traditional then for illegal immigrants. And each was benefited by the amnesty enacted early in the first Roosevelt administration so that they were eligible to apply for it and become citizens. They married in 1925.
In the Pittsburgh area?
In Pittsburgh, correct. They lived for a very short period in Houston, Texas, Galveston, Texas, where my father had an uncle. But they eventually settled here, and this was where they have been virtually the whole time. I have two older sisters, also twins, twin sisters who were born in 1926. They're 2 years and a couple of weeks older than I am.
Are they also in the Pittsburgh area?
They are both still in Pittsburgh. One lives within walking distance. One lives down in Coriopolis, where my parents lived from 1932 until now. In fact, my mother and father lived in the house which they bought in 1941 until my father's death, which was just this past October. He died just short of his 91st birthday. My mother still lives in the house. They've occupied it since 1941. But we moved from the Hill District of Pittsburgh to Coraopolis early in 1932.
You must have some strong memories of that period in Coraopolis, the Depression.
I surely do. As a matter of fact, it was one of those situations where my mother was constantly fearful that I was about to be killed because we lived in a house right in the middle of my Uncle Charlie Fingerette's scrapyard. And right across the street was a dairy farm garage, and I was always over there, and she was sure I was going to be run over by a truck. So she lied about my age and put me into the first grade in the Coraopolis Public Schools when I was 4 years old, which resulted in my finishing high school when I was 16 and college when I was 19, and possibly had a major influence on my personality development. But in any event, I sure do have some very vivid memories of the Depression, of the 1936 St. Patrick's Day flood, by which time I was in the fourth grade in school and had to be carried out of my house because the house that we lived in at that time was flooded. I couldn't get the car out of the garage. We came to Pittsburgh to spend about a week at the home of one of my aunts on Howell Street here in Shadyside until we could get back into our house. The WPA folks were there shoveling the mud out of people's basements and yards and so forth. And there were some very tough times. Pennies were hard to come by, I can tell you. My father was in the scrap iron and auto wrecking business. I've told this story so many times that I really get tired of telling it, but it's one of the things that occurred. My father took in junk a hearse from one of the local undertakers. It was apparently worn out, and he took it in. Under ordinary circumstances, it would have been turned over and salvageable parts removed and certain metal parts cut off, and then the body would have been burned to get rid of the upholstery and the wood structures and so forth, and what remained would have been pressed. But this, in this case, rather than burning the upholstery, he removed it. It was that real heavy gray wool upholstery that was on the inside of old-fashioned hearses, and he removed it and brought it home. And my mother made a jacket and a pair of knickers for me out of that material. And I was one of the very few kids in the school who was warm that winter, because I want to tell you that woolen upholstery fabric was very, very warm. I don't know where she got the money for the full-length zipper that was on that jacket. She apparently saved pennies out of the household money for a long enough period to buy a zipper for that jacket, but it's a memory that I will have with me always.
Do you have memories of the Jewish community in Coraopolis that you want to share?
Oh, sure. We had a small but very united Jewish community, maybe 25 to 30 Jewish families. But there was always a congregation. There was an old house that was made into a shul, or a shiel as we call it, from our gubernia, and it existed, and that's where I had my bar mitzvah, and that's where I went to Sunday school, and where I later taught Sunday school, and so forth. And my father was always proud of the fact that after I was married, my sister, one of my sisters was married, and we all used to get together on Friday evenings at my father's house for dinner, and he would go to shul, and if they didn't have a minyan, he would call the house, and my brother-in-law and I would hotfoot down there and He was so happy to say, Ich hab gemacht zwei Eden, you know, for the benefit of those who understand, don't understand. He made two Jews so that they could have a minion on Friday nights if they needed it. But it was an active group, old-timers, basically immigrants, that is the leaders of the congregation, but there were first-generation folks like us who were there too. Years later, and long after I moved out of the community, they acquired a formal building and what have you. And now that's all gone by the boards, and they're in a merger with other communities in the area. But in those years, we had an independent, freestanding organization. And for the holidays, of course, Chazan was brought in for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we had what Jews in the small towns in the area had in those days.
About what years were they?
Well, as I say, from 1932, when we moved into Coriopolis, I moved out of Coriopolis in 1949, which was when I was married. Got out of college in 47, 49 I was married. I moved out of Coriopolis then, but I maintain my ties with the community. My parents are still there, and one of my sisters.
Was it comfortable to be a Jewish boy growing up in Coriopolis in those years?
No, it was not. Coriopolis is a very, very Italian town, although there was no kind of violent or virulent anti-Semitism. There was a constant kind of thing, which was very common in those days. The epithet Dirty Jew was not unknown to me. But generally, I was able to get along and eventually made my peace with the community, and in fact have some very, very close friends from the Gentile community in Coriopolis from my high school days to this day. Very, very good friends, people with whom I maintain a very close relationship. And I guess very different personalities make different adjustments. And I think that by the time I reached my teenage years, I really didn't have any discernible problems. I was able to give as good as I got, pretty much, and maybe not physically, but otherwise, I was able pretty much to handle myself, and the problems didn't amount to very much then. But as a younger child, I was very keenly aware of my Jewish status and of the fact that when people called me a Jew, they were doing so in a pejorative sense, and they really didn't have any good feelings about it.
What about school during that time, Marty? Were there teachers who had some special effect? Do you have any strong or important memories of education during those growing up years?
I do. I think we had a very good school system. It was a small school system, but I think a good one. I had one English teacher. Everybody has one favorite teacher that he or she thinks was very influential. I had an English teacher when I was in high school named Mary Crawford over in Sewickley. I think that my respect for the proper use of the English language owes its existence to Mary Crawford. And I haven't given that up. I teach at the Pitt Law School now. I teach third-year law students. I am constantly preaching to them about their failures in English. I guess they're not responsible for it. They didn't get any proper training, but I did. And we had a fellow named Jimmy McLaughlin, who taught a lot of science courses. I took them all, chemistry and physics and all of the math courses, and he was very, very good and kind of an inspirational person, made you feel good. And if you succeeded, and in those days, there was no stigma to succeeding in school. You know, you hear today that the students, if they don't want to be known as greasy grinds, and they they suffer the opprobrium of their fellows if they succeed. Well, that didn't exist. And if I succeeded in school, I was happy about it. My friends were happy about it. Nobody seemed to think that you were a bad person if you got A's.
You mentioned earlier your memories of the flood. Were there other events going on around you in the world that were important, that had some seminal effect, or that you remember this part of your environment?
Well, of course, the central event of my growing up years was World War II. There couldn't be anything which was more central to the existence of somebody raised the way I was, and I might tell you about that. My father had little or no formal education, but he was a man who insisted upon being aware of what was happening and making certain that his children were aware. Just give you an example. There used to be on the radio every night for 15 minutes was a Lowell Thomas news show. And that's the time that we sat down to dinner in our house. And no one was permitted to talk at our table during the news broadcast. We had to listen to the news. Once the news was over, we were permitted to talk about the news. Now, I tell you, as honestly as I sit here today, that when Adolf Hitler was named by President Hindenburg to be Chancellor of Germany in January of 1933, I was not quite 5 years old when that occurred. I understood the significance of that as fully as though I had been an adult. In 1933, I knew about the 1923 Beer Hall Putsch. I was taught about it. I knew what it meant. And it's just as though I were an adult, I swear to you. That's because that's the way we were raised. We had to know those things. We had to know about it. When the Lindbergh trial was in existence, for example, I was a big booster for Bruno Richard Hauptmann. I've learned since by reading transcripts that they had pretty nearly everything but the movies of him coming down the ladder with the Lindbergh baby. But you see, I had such terrible animosity to Lindbergh, who I knew to be an anti-Semite, even then in the early 30s when I was a young child.
Was this because of your father?
Yes, because that's the way my father raised us. We had to know. He insisted that we know what was happening. That was a part of our upbringing. We had to know. And it's a thing that has stuck with me all the way. If I'm a political animal, it's based upon that kind of early training. And if I didn't know, I was in trouble. And it aroused in me the kinds of curiosity that have persisted to this day. There's very little that goes on anywhere in the world that I don't know about. I make it my business. And, of course, as I say, World War II. And I can recite to you today from memory the order of battle as it went on in Europe and in Asia and in Africa and throughout. You know, Mirza Matru and El Alamein and Tobruk and Bardichev and Zhytomyr and Minsk and Pinsk and Akhmolinsk are just as fresh in my memory today as they were then. I followed the news of World War II as though my life depended on it. And I guess in many ways it did. And then, of course, at the conclusion of the war, when we learned that my father's family had been destroyed, all but two first cousins, my first cousins, my father's brother's sister and my father's brother's daughter and my father's sister's daughter survived. To this day, I met them in Moscow in 1985, and they're coming to Pittsburgh for a visit in April of this year, and I'm looking forward to it with great glee.
Yes.
We were able to communicate, even though they don't speak any English. I don't speak any Russian, but we all speak Yiddish.
Did your father keep in touch with the family
throughout? No, my father really did not, but my father's brother, my uncle, who mm-hmm. also lives in Pittsburgh, did. After World War II, he made the necessary contacts through the refugee agencies and located them and was in touch with them, visited them, and then other members of the family visited them and so forth. The father never did. There are reasons for it. Not that he didn't feel for it, and I really didn't learn about it, and it came as a matter of great amazement to me, and I'm disclosing this to you. It's something that I've never disclosed to anyone. When I got back from Russia in 1985, I spoke with my father, who at the time, in fact, was in the Shadyside Hospital, having his gallbladder removed, then at the age of 87 or 88. Came through that like it was nothing. But when I spoke with my father there, I said, you know, Dad, Vera, that's one of my cousins, Vera and Lisa are very upset. They never hear from you. They say we hear from Fetter Pini, but not from Fetter Avrum. And you're the oldest. And, you know, they talk about how their father, Yankel, used to talk about Avrum, and they never hear from Avrum, and they would love to hear from Avrum. Why don't they hear from Avrum? I said, you know, Dad, you really ought. And he said, you know what, Moshe? I can't write. And that's the first time in my life that I knew, and I was almost 60 years old at the time, that my father couldn't write. He was a businessman. He made a success of himself. He didn't know how to write. I never knew that. He had acquired enough skill so that he could make a sales slip in the course of his business and so forth, but that was it. And I had never known that until that time. And he had never disclosed it, but I guess in the light of what I had told him about what his nieces had said, he made that disclosure to me at that time. And as I say, it came as a real surprise.
It's a very touching story.
Most certainly. It touched me, I'll tell you.
Because this was clearly a man who admired knowledge mm-hmm. and who was yeah. very concerned about his family's yeah. cultivation.
He could read Yiddish and taught himself really to read English. He mm-hmm. could read the newspapers. It wasn't easy for him, but he did. But he was a man who succeeded in business. He got to the point of having a very comfortable retirement income. He didn't have to worry about where any of his wherewithal was coming from. He didn't have to rely on his children or anything of the kind, but he didn't know how to write. Mm-hmm. Just didn't have enough education to know how to write.
Let's go back to you. After high school, your choice to go to the university, the way in which you chose law, do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, law was a kind of a stumble in for me, so to speak. I had always been groomed, as were most Jewish boys, I guess, of my era, to go to medical school, or be a doctor. You've heard, I'm sure, the old joke that a lawyer is a reasonably intelligent Jewish boy who can't stand the sight of blood. That wasn't my problem. I couldn't get into medical school, that's all. And I'm delighted that I couldn't get into medical school, as it turned out. But in those days, my children, of course, all went to undergraduate school out of the city. One mm-hmm. went to New York City. One went to Oberlin, Ohio. One went to out in Iowa to Grinnell, Iowa. Graduate schools were elsewhere and so forth. But in our day, families, stayed at home. I went to Pitt. That's what you did. I lived at home and commuted to Pitt. And I was an undergraduate student, as a pre-medical student. I didn't get into medical school, which wasn't the worst thing in the world, although I thought it was at the time. And I married in 1949. And in 1954, when I had acquired a wife and two children and house and a mortgage and a car and what have you, I just wasn't fully satisfied with my life up to that point.
What were you doing at that point?
Well, I did a number of things. At that particular time, I was in business with my father. I had gone into my father's business, but it just didn't do it for me. I'd spent some time as a chemist with the United States Bureau of Mines out in Brewston, and Then I went into business with my dad, or went into his business. But I really wasn't satisfied. I had a lot of friends from my college days who had always urged me to go to law school, and I just couldn't picture that. I thought that that had to be the dullest, driest kind of study imaginable. In the summer of 1954, and by that time I'd been out of college 7 years, as I was kind of casting around, I bumped into a fraternity brother of mine from Pitt, who was teaching school, and asked him how I was doing. And he told me he was going to law school at night. I said, I never heard of such a thing. He said, oh yeah, Duquesne University has an evening law school. In fact, that's all they had. They had no day school. And I'm in my, I just finished the first year. I'm going into my second. How long does it take? It takes 4 years. I said, gee, it's only a year longer. Can you get in? I said, well, you take an examination if you do well. So I went down and I just thought about it. And I went down and talked to them down there. And I took the aptitude test, the necessary aptitude test, and sent in mine. And I got into school. And I figured, what can it cost me? I'll try it for a year. And strangely enough, I fell in love with the study. I found it to be the most fascinating kind of study. The English common law is a very fascinating subject. It is extremely logical. It flows in such a fashion I could spend hours and hours and hours with you explaining the historical development of the English common law, but I fell in love with it. I fancy myself as a bit of a student of history, and when I studied real estate law as a first-year law student and realized that what I was studying really was the fight between the king and the pope, and that is the basis for the real estate law that we live by in Pennsylvania today. Why, it just was, I loved it. But in any event, that's what I did. I completed law school and passed the bar exam and went into the practice of law, which I always enjoyed very, very much. And that led eventually to the bench where I've been and where I'll stay, I guess, until splinters from the bench force me off.
Let's back up again to your meeting with the woman who would be your wife. And a bit about her background, about those early years of your marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, too, because I knew Selma for a number of... I knew her when I was still in high school. Huh. She wasn't my friend. She was the friend of my sister's.
Was she also from Coriolis?
No, she was from Pittsburgh, from the South Side. And she and my sisters, my twin sisters, were members of a club at the YMHA on Belfield Street. And so she knew my sisters. And I was their brother. So we kind of knew each other. I remember Selma came out to Coriolis when I was in my senior year in high school because I had the lead in the class play, and my sisters convinced her to come out to see me in the class play. But I knew Selma. And we were at Pitt together. We graduated together, both of us in the class of 47. I never dated Selma, but we knew each other. I dated Selma first when we were both seniors in college. In November of 1946, we graduated in June of 47. Late November 46 was the first time I'd ever dated Selma. What had happened was, I had a first cousin, one of the Fingerette boys from Los Angeles, who was in the Navy down in Washington, was here in Pittsburgh on a leave, and I double dated with him. I was going with a girl from East Liberty, and I got him a date. I called Selma, asked if she'd go out with my, and she did, and I said, gee, she seems like a hell of a girl to me. And then I started dating her, and once I dated her, I tell you, I never dated anybody else. And we were married in May of 1949. It'll be 40 years in a couple of months since we've been married.
Were you married in Pittsburgh?
Here in Pittsburgh at the William Penn Hotel in the Eubin Room. Mm-hmm. And her parents are both immigrants as well. Her father came to this country as a fairly young boy.
The name of your wife?
Selma Finkelstein was her maiden name. And that's a funny thing, too, because my daughter Kathy's married to a young man named Finkelstein. Uh-huh. So, you know, I've got them on both sides. I've got grandchildren named Finkelstein, and the children named Finkelstein, and Schwer and Schwieger named Finkelstein. Mm-hmm. But they came from Lithuania. Selma's father came here, shortly after World War I, as a fairly young boy. He went back to Europe to bring his future wife back with him, Selma's mother, and they married. And they were in business over on the south side in the grocery business. And Selma's father's still alive. Her mother died in